coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. With lawmakers headed off on spring recess, we take a look at where things stand in Dover on key issues like changes to Delaware's tax brackets.
I do expect we will see some type of personal income tax bracket bill hit the House floor this session.
DPM state politics reporter Sarah Petrovich joins us on The Green this week. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the rise in vaping and nicotine use among young people and efforts to combat it. Arts Playlist previews the Southern Delaware Orchestra's spring season, and Enlighten Me introduces us to a local author releasing a new memoir. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A week after Governor Matt Meyer delivered his first State of the State address, lawmakers embark on their two-week spring recess, an opportunity to regroup before this year's legislative session heads into its stretch run. So where do things stand following Governor Meyer's State of the State and his budget presentation? And what issues are likely to dominate lawmakers' attention in May and June? This week, I sat down with Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrovich to delve into the current state of play in Dover. So let's start with Governor Matt Meyer's State of the State and some of the priorities he laid out in that address last week. One is a commitment to adding new tax brackets for high-end earners to produce more revenue. Tell us a bit more about that plan and what kind of support he has for it at this point.
Yeah, that was definitely the headliner of his State of the State and his budget. So the current floor for Delaware's highest tax bracket is $60,000, which means in theory, someone who's making $60,000 and someone who's making $200,000 or more are being taxed at the same rate. And Governor Meyer has been a proponent of creating more tax equity within these brackets, or what he calls having people pay their fair share. So he is proposing three new tax brackets for earners at the $125,000, $250,000, and $500,000 threshold. He says that change won't raise taxes for anybody making around $132,000 a year or below, and in fact will actually slightly lower the tax rate for 92% of Delawareans. So the rate increases are only slightly higher than the current highest bracket, so this is really only expected to modestly increase Delaware's income, which I believe is why when I talk to lawmakers after the address, there seems to be mixed reception as to if this is the best plan. Now, it sounds like Democrats are in consensus that the personal income tax brackets need to change, but what exactly that change is still undecided within the caucus. And I also say Democrats intentionally because not only do they have a majority in both chambers, they actually have a 3/5 majority in both chambers, which means they can pass tax bracket changes without Republican support, which hasn't been the case in years prior. But Republicans are still making it clear they don't believe these tax bracket changes are the best move. When I spoke with Republican leadership, they were concerned that these new higher brackets would impact small businesses the most and would also de-incentivize high earners from moving to Delaware, which the state is always trying to recruit more doctors, more high school professionals in general, et cetera. So there is a bill filed in the House by State Representative Sean Lynn that proposes these exact changes that Meyer wants to make. House Speaker Melissa Minor Brown says she doesn't know if that's going to be the version that will make it across the finish line, but I do expect we will see some type of personal income tax bracket bill hit the House floor this session. And just to note, Senate Democrats seem to be on a similar page in that they're not opposed to the tax bracket changes, but it sounds like they want to look at a more holistic approach to fix Delaware's larger revenue problem, considering these changes still wouldn't completely make up for the close to $500 million deficit that the state is expecting within the next couple of years.
So that was one highlight from the speech. The other, I think, was Meyer kind of drawing a line in the sand on one of his key campaign issues, and that's developing a new education funding formula. He says he wants a framework passed by the end of session, June 30th. And in this case, it looks like he may get his wish. What is the latest from your reporting on this week on where education funding's at?
Yes, when I initially talked to legislative leadership right after his speech, the consensus from both sides of the aisle was there's pretty much no way an education funding formula could pass by the end of this session. And that's not a new sentiment. It has been brought up at Public Education Funding Commission meetings, which is the body in charge of making those recommendations on how to change Delaware's current funding formula to make it more equitable, that the commission has agreed upon sending its first set of recommendations to the governor by October, and then not even finalizing its recommendations until July of next year. But they had heard that the governor was hoping for some more concrete plans by this summer, and at first Secretary of Education Cindy Martin added some nuance to that expectation, saying that the governor understands it's going to take a couple of years to implement an entirely new formula, But based on the commission's Monday meeting, it sounds like they're really pushing ahead with this potential timeline. The key distinction here is passing a framework versus an actual model. The framework would at least outline how Delaware would change its current funding structure, but a model would include exactly what new buckets of funding would be implemented. So it's kind of inside baseball, but basically the administration is really hoping for at least some semblance of proof that a change to Delaware's education funding model is coming. And if the General Assembly can approve that by the end of this legislative session, then work can continue to be done to perfect what the model will actually be. Although it is worth noting, at this most recent meeting, one of the school district's chief financial officers said she thought that passing a model by the summer would be impossible. But Cindy Martin said that she's not so sure they should write it off as a possibility. So all in all, it does seem like the commission is going to push very hard to have a framework by the summer. They even added extra meetings to their calendar to make this happen. But whether or not we will see a full fleshed out funding formula in the coming months is yet to be seen.
Anything else stand out from the state of the state?
Yeah, there were a couple of other hot button issues. He'd mentioned, you know, reviving a homelessness task force, some affordable housing efforts. He also intends to eliminate $50 billion worth of medical debt and is asking the legislature to look into legislation that would keep medical debt from affecting credit reports. We hadn't really heard much on that before, so this kind of seems like a at least new to us effort from Meyer. He also reinforced his commitment to expanding the Port of Wilmington, which we'll get into a little bit later, as well as support for Delaware's recreational marijuana market getting back on track, which we'll also dive into deeper later.
Before we do any of that, though, let's talk a little bit about the budget. Ahead of the State of the State, Governor Meyer also laid out his budget proposal, calling it a reset from what lawmakers were working on from former Governor John Carney. We already talked about maybe the biggest piece of that, trying to update the tax brackets to address revenue growth lagging behind rising expenditures. But there's also, of course, the uncertainty surrounding federal funding cuts adding to the mix. That prompted Meyer to lay out some plans to address this kind of looming budget pinch beyond just changing the tax brackets. And let's start with capital spending, because he wants to pull back pretty significantly there, right?
Yeah, this is something we've been seeing in recent years just because of the fizzling out of COVID relief funds, specifically American Rescue Plan Act dollars. And former Governor John Carney's administration opted to spend the majority of those funds on one-time spending capital improvement projects. So seeing a decline is only natural at this point. But during Governor Meyer's budget presentation, his Office of Management and Budget Director Brian Maxwell made a comment about how when you're looking for places to cut, it's easier to cut cash to the bond bill. And some argue he needs to cut more, right? Because then you don't have to cut programs or jobs at the state level. And although cutting funding to the bond bill does save money, it doesn't address this operating budget that's growing far beyond what the state's annual revenue growth is increasing at. So it's kind of low-hanging fruit, you could say, in terms of shrinking a budget. But I noticed that at this year's capital improvement budget hearings, committee members were pretty disappointed with the amount of cuts that they saw. So
we'll keep an eye on that. On the other hand, Meyer is looking at grant and aid funding differently. What's his plan for that funding? And that funding, we should note, goes to fire companies, nonprofits, arts organizations, other community groups, including, for full transparency, Delaware Public Media.
Yes, Governor Meyer is recommending $4.6 million more in support for nonprofits than Governor Carney did, bringing the annual grants and aid bill to a total of $82.8 million. I think this just aligns with his platform approach of investing more in community resources and programming to see better outcomes, which also explains why he's not too keen on cutting the operating budget, right? At this point, he would rather raise revenue sources and cut capital spending and invest in nonprofits to try to even out that budget. So
the other interesting thing I thought we saw was Meyer's approach to the budget stabilization fund. Some people may remember it more as the budget smoothing process that was created under former Governor John Carney. What does Meyer intend to do with that fund?
Yeah, this has been pretty interesting, even from when he was campaigning. The budget stabilization fund, definitely a proponent of former Governor John Carney, at least trying to advocate for having funds and reserves that could be used in emergency situations, potentially what we're about to see in the coming years. So as far as the current budget proposal, if nothing were to change, if we can't find new revenue sources or decrease our spending, Delaware is looking at depleting the budget stabilization fund entirely over the next two fiscal years and then would face a $500 million deficit even after depleting those funds in fiscal year 2028. So there's a really good chance that Governor Meyer could use up the entire budget stabilization fund, but maybe irony is a little bit too strong of a word, but he intends to not replenish that fund. He says he's not in favor of, quote, socking funds away. He believes in taking enough revenue from Delawareans from tax income and spending it accordingly rather than saving it as a just-in-case method. And he's repeatedly doubled down on that. So whether or not he does decide to contribute to the budget stabilization fund, whether or not he uses it in its entirety is still on the table. But it seems like lawmakers from both sides of the aisle are in a consensus that they want to keep this fund alive, even though the governor does not.
I feel like from much of what we've talked about, I think it's fair to say that there are multiple points of divergence between Governor Meyer and state lawmakers, even in his own party. And nowhere has that been more evident than the ongoing battle over the port board nominees, which returned to the news this week after it appeared to be settled a few weeks ago when the Delaware Supreme Court sided with Meyer on his right to withdraw nominees named by Governor Hall Long during her brief time in office in January and replace them with his own. This week, Democratic leadership in the Senate said not so fast. So what's the latest on the port board and the friction there between really specifically state Senate Democratic leadership and the governor?
Yes. So yesterday, three of Meyer's nominees were confirmed by the Senate Executive Committee, and that was Wednesday. Those candidates include business agent for the International Longshoremen's Association, Local 1883, Kamoko Harris. And we also have former Delaware Board of Pilot Commissioners Chair Robert Jerry Med and former Newcastle County Board of Adjustment Chair David Burt. So they all received their approval from the Senate Executive Committee and now will go to the full Senate for confirmation. Also approved with Secretary of State Charuni Pativana Sanchez as the new chair of the board. But prior to that, on Monday, Senate leadership sent out a statement saying nominees Jen Cohan, a former DelDOT secretary, and Gene Bailey, the former director of the Diamond State Port Corporation and Port of Wilmington, would not be receiving a hearing due to a desire for, quote, different voices. And this is a little bit interesting because it's a preemptive rejection. They didn't even receive a hearing before being denied. When we asked the Meyer administration for comment on those two nominees being rejected, he declined to comment. But we are under the impression he will send two new nominees in there shortly. So we at least have three settled and we have the chair of the board settled. So that's coming. But we also have this task force that just got passed in both chambers of the General Assembly that requires monthly reports as far as the status of the port and expanding that Edgemoor Port project. And this is kind of seen by the Meyer administration as an unnecessary oversight measure. And even it's seen as unnecessary by some lawmakers in the House who voted against the measure, saying that we are putting too many restrictions on the process and we really need to get this done is essentially what they are vocalizing. So the tension continues. And we will still have to see whether or not those two new nominees that come through are approved by the Senate, as well as the future of the project as a whole. But Secretary of State Charuni Pativana Sanchez did reinforce that the Meyer administration is committed to the project, which has been up for debate between Senate leadership and Meyer previously.
The project being the Edgemoor expansion, which has been in the works for some time. And the other thing I do want to clarify is the task force that was created is really a revival of a previous task force that was to help kind of guide the creation of this project. Now they're bringing it back to oversee progress of the project.
Right. The initial iteration of the task force was to essentially explore the feasibility of the expansion project, and now it's really coming back as more of an oversight. So yes, it is a revival, and that's important to know, but it's definitely playing a new role in this iteration.
Sure. The other thing you've been covering recently has been delays in getting the legal recreational marijuana industry launched and the various remedy efforts that are going on. Where do things stand with getting legal weed up and running in Delaware?
Yeah, we're definitely on our way, but also it seems like it's one step forward, three steps back. So State Representative Ed Ozinski introduced a bill that would remedy the federal background check process that in theory will get the recreational marijuana industry back on track. It's a little bit technical as to why the background checks for business license holders were denied in the first place. But once this bill is signed into law, that piece of the puzzle should be resolved. It awaits a vote in the Senate, which is happening later today as we record this on Thursday. And Governor Meyer has already pledged to sign it. But it's still unclear how long the background checks will take after these changes are made. Governor Meyer also said in his State of the State that we should expect a new marijuana commissioner within days, but it's now been a week and we don't have a name as of today, which again is Thursday. And even once the name is released, they will still have to undergo Senate confirmation. So we're waiting for that appointment. And finally, State Senator Trey Pardee's bill that would limit how much a county can restrict zoning ordinances for marijuana dispensaries, which has been quite contentious in the prior months, that awaits committee approval and a full vote in the House, but it's likely to pass. So lawmakers are making moves at getting the industry back on track, but it's still unclear when the market will be ready to go as of this point.
So we'll wrap up by asking you, is there anything else as lawmakers head out on their 2-week spring break that we should be keeping an eye on for what's to come during these last couple of months of the session?
Definitely, yeah. So in addition to that tax bracket legislation, as well as a potential education funding framework, there's still several things that are coming down the pike. Senate Majority Leader Brian Townsend's constitutional amendment to eliminate cash bail release for high-level offenses like capital murder is in the home stretch. It already passed through both chambers last year and passed unanimously through the Senate this year, but House leadership seems a little bit shakier on it this time around. House Majority Leader Carrie Evelyn Harris said during its committee hearing, with the current federal backdrop, she's worried it could increase racial and economic disparities and influence defendants to take plea deals rather than going to trial if they're being held up in preventative detention without the option for bail. So it was released unanimously from committee, but it will be worth keeping an eye on how its vote on the House floor goes. We also have another constitutional amendment from Townsend that would constitutionalize abortion and other reproductive rights. We also have two constitutional amendments from Senator Darius Brown that would codify early voting, permanent absentee voting, and no-excuse mail-in voting, which has had a lot of legal trouble over the past couple of years. So all four of those amendments passed in the Delaware Senate, but they head to the House and will need the approval from at least one Republican lawmaker to pass. So those will definitely be worth keeping an eye on. And State Representative Sean Lynn also introduced a four-bill package that all essentially look to restrict local law enforcement's ability to cooperate with federal agencies conducting immigration enforcement activities, especially within schools and sensitive areas. The only bill that has been released from committee is one that would prohibit the Department of Education, public schools, and operators of companies that hold digital student data from sharing students' information with immigration enforcement agencies without permission from the Delaware Attorney General. And finally, we're recording this Thursday morning, and legalizing medical aid in dying, colloquially known as physician-assisted suicide, is on today's agenda in the Senate, which is in its final steps before receiving a signature from Matt Meyer, who has pledged his support for it. Senate Majority Leader Brian Townsend, who is the sponsor of the bill, says he expects it to pass on the same narrow margins it did last year of 11 to 10 before Governor Carney vetoed it. So if all goes accordingly, that bill will have cleared the General Assembly and received gubernatorial support after more than a decade's worth of effort.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrovich for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We examine the rise in vaping and nicotine use among young Americans and what's being done to address it. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Cigarette smoking has fallen to its lowest level in the United States in more than 60 years. But even as fewer adults light up, e-cigarette use continues to climb, particularly among younger Americans. New data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows the number of adults exclusively using e-cigarettes more than tripled from 2017 to 2023, with the sharpest increases among younger adults. Public health officials say that shift offsets much of the progress made in reducing tobacco use overall, raising new concerns about nicotine addiction and the long-term health effects of vaping. Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry caught up this week with Dr. Victor Banzon, a pulmonary medicine specialist at BB Healthcare, to discuss what's fueling this rise in vaping among young people and efforts to address it.
Doctor, we're seeing a steady decline in cigarette smoking, according to new data from the CDC, but vaping is still headed in the opposite direction, especially among younger adults. What do you make of that, and what's driving that trend?
It's a very good question. Vaping, as you know, has been a big subject and a serious subject, especially amongst the adolescent population. The New England Journal of Medicine had a significant article in 2020 that looked at vaping deaths called e-cigarette vaping acute lung injury. And especially in the Midwest, there was a lot of reported acute respiratory distress syndrome amongst the teenage world. And that was the focus at that time, late 2019 and early 2020. Unfortunately, the same time frame of COVID. And once COVID hit, we kind of put vaping-induced lung disease on the back burner on the shelf. I think COVID took precedent, which it should. And now with COVID being stabilized, you're right. We are looking at a resurgence of adolescents using vaping products as a means to be cool, be part of the gang, peer pressure. Statistically, there has been reports from the CDC that smoking cessation has improved with the help of vaping products. We do know that vaping has improved the outcomes of smoking cessation amongst smokers in the adult population. But with that use of vaping in that realm, we have seen an increase of use of vaping, especially amongst the adolescent population. In the United States, the highest belt of location for smoking is Kentucky, Tennessee, and West Virginia, and part of Delaware. We're very close to that area. Unfortunately, it is underestimated the degree of adolescents who are using vaping products. The products that we see that are really detrimental to the adolescents is not necessarily the nicotine that they put in. And some people also use the vaping products for using cannabis products. But it's really the other products that are dangerous, called the vitamin E or the hydrocarbons. These are the ones that are known to cause significant lung disease and acute respiratory distress syndrome. Interestingly, I had a patient of mine who told me that they found out that their 14-year-old son was using vaping, and the son has asthma. And they, you know, they did parental discussion asking him, well, how long has this been going on? Since the age of almost 12 and a half, and he felt peer pressure.
Well, some people also turn to e-cigarettes believing they're a safer alternative to smoking. Are the health risks associated with smoking lowered when vaping, or does it remain the same?
Excellent question. And again, the data out there is significant. When the New England Journal of Medicine article came out in adolescence, there was 19 reported acute lung injury cases. And again, it is because of the substance that is in the vaping products, such as the vitamin E acetate, the hydrocarbons, other fillers that manufacturers are putting into the vaping products, that is very dangerous and can worsen patients who have underlying or unsuspected lung disease, such as asthma, or bronchiectasis, or even cystic fibrosis. So I would say that vaping technically is not a safer mode of using nicotine than cigarettes because of the risk factors of developing acute lung injury and worsening asthma and worsening underlying respiratory diseases.
Now, when people are smoking cigarettes and they turn to vaping, is that like a gateway to possibly stop smoking completely? And, or vice versa, when people go to vaping first, is that also a gateway maybe to cigarettes? Do you know how that works?
The marketing of vaping companies have marketed it as a way to promote smoking cessation. The data on smoking cessation, right now, the CDC has reported that smoking cessation has declined with the use of vaping, but you are correct that vaping does cause in adolescents a gateway to using either marijuana through the vaping or leading to other modalities of smoke related products, such as tobacco products. So it is a very difficult time in our society as to what the ramifications of vaping is, especially amongst the adolescents.
You touched on this in your first answer, but from a clinical perspective, have you seen more patients experiencing health issues linked to vaping in recent years?
It's amazing the number of patients I see daily, and we discuss with them their smoking cessation efforts, and they tell me they stopped smoking and they're not using any products. But guess what? When I examine them and they have in their pocket a vaping product And then I look at it and I confront them, or I say, hey, that's a vape. Oh, I forgot about this. So again, it is something that is underestimated and not forthcoming amongst patients on the degree of how much they use vaping products. And I think it is a problem in the United States.
One of the concerns health officials have raised is that the rise in vaping has chipped away at the overall progress made in reducing traditional smoking and tobacco use. How significant is that setback from your view?
The American Thoracic Society, American College of Chest Physicians, smoking cessation is well documented. Each time a patient comes in, we review the five A's of smoking cessation, which is ask, assess, advise, assist, and accomplish. And then there was a study called EAGLES, which was called the Evaluation of Adverse Global Lung Smoking Cessation Efforts. This was a JAMA article which showed that dual therapy with nicotine replacement with Chantix or Wellbutrin had better outcomes. This was in 2016 in JAMA, and the previous side effects of Chantix or Wellbutrin was not substantiated. When patients come into my office, I go over the five A's with them. I tell them that the data with dual therapy, with nicotine replacement, with another medication has better outcomes. The reality is patients listen to that, but the nicotine addiction is very difficult, and it is very difficult for patients to stop nicotine replacement or the need for nicotine. Vaping is an easy out because patients don't want to necessarily listen about five A's. They don't want to hear beyond the nicotine gum or patch, and they don't want to be on medication, so they use vaping as a next tool. Again, vaping has shown to reduce smoking, but unfortunately, it has those other potential issues with lung injury and worsening respiratory issues with asthma and worsening COPD because of the products that are additionally in the vaping system.
In terms of how this is being addressed, what kinds of prevention and education efforts are happening right now here in Delaware or nationally to curb vaping among young people, and what seems to be working?
That is a very good question. When you get a habit-forming process amongst teenagers and adolescents, it kind of takes off. Legally, again, I know that there is a Supreme Court hearing looking at e-cigarette companies and determining what the FDA is going to approve or not allow them to promote and determine the risk factors and the risk to adolescents in the United States. I don't know what or when that hearing is going to be taking place, but I think it's a step forward that the government, both on a state and federal level, needs to understand the clinical implications and the risk factors for our adolescent population who are becoming early adults. So that's one aspect. Again, parental guidance and supervision and questioning the adolescents what they're doing. And sometimes if they're very suspicious, I think you need to make the next step forward is to have a significant discussion with that adolescent about what they're truly doing, as the case of my patient who found out that his son was vaping for over a year and a half.
Thanks to BB Healthcare Pulmonary Medicine Specialist Dr. Victor Banzon and our Joey Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Art's Playlist and a trip to Sussex County, where the Southern Delaware Orchestra is tuning up for its spring concert series. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The music you're hearing is from the Southern Delaware Orchestra's summer concert series last year. And the community ensemble, also known as Sodello, is back again this season, bringing its Sounds of the Spring concert to Sussex County. The performances, set for April 26th and 27th, offer a mix of classical favorites and contemporary pieces, all celebrating nature and the arrival of spring. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by Sodelo's co-founder and music director, James Allen Anderson, for more on these upcoming concerts.
So this concert is called Sounds of Spring, a musical river journey through Europe. Where are we going?
So yeah, this is an extraordinary program that we believe will help us usher in the spring. And it does have an aquatic theme. We begin with a work by Bedrich Smetana called The Moldau, which is a tone poem from a larger collection he titled Ma Vlast, or My Country. And it really depicts a journey down the Moldau River, starting at the headwaters and making our way through the Bohemian countryside until we arrive in triumph in the city of Prague.
And I notice you also have another very famous river here, the Blue Danube.
Yeah, so we have sort of bookends with these river ideas, right? And so the program will close with Strauss's Blue Danube. Strauss, of course, the city of Vienna, where we have the creation of the waltz. The Blue Danube is one of the most iconic compositions of that genre. And it features five different waltzes that run consecutively. And it's a very elegant work. You know, this is the city that invented the waltz. And so we feel like it's, again, one of these sort of joyous pieces that helps usher in the spring.
Arguably the biggest work on this concert is the Schubert Unfinished Symphony, which has a pretty interesting history. Can you tell me a little bit about the work and about Franz Schubert, who is a really fascinating composer?
Yeah, so Schubert, a very interesting composer. He's one of these artists that sits on the cusp of what we call the classical period and the romantic period. And yeah, it's a brooding work. It was left unfinished in his lifetime. We only have two movements from the symphony, an allegro molto and an andante con molto. And so we're doing something sort of interesting with this program. The format for the entire concert follows this typical overture, concerto, symphony construction. And so what we're doing when we add the Blue Danube into the mix is we're helping to complete this unfinished symphony. And it's we're not really sure why it was left unfinished. There is some conjecture about he was grappling with illness. Some people believe that he actually felt the pieces, the two movements, stood alone on their own. And I believe they do. They're really extraordinary works, but they have these elements of early romanticism, very brooding opening section. And so we feel like the Blue Danube, which is a waltz, is the typical third movement of a symphony anyways, a dance form of sorts. And we think that if the audience really wants to hear a little bit more music and they encourage us at the end of the concert, we might be able to provide a fourth movement as well.
And of course, the Blue Danube, written in the city of Vienna. Schubert also spent a lot of his tragically short life in Vienna as well.
That's correct. Yeah. So a very fertile grounds for creativity. Some would argue the greatest musical capital in the world. So Brahms and Schubert and Mahler and Schoenberg and, you know, the list goes on. There's a wonderful central cemetery there that has all these artists are buried there. And a dream of mine would be to one day do a performance of their music in that central cathedral there at the cemetery.
One piece on the concert that stood out to me is the Haydn Trumpet Concerto. And one interesting thing to me about that piece, I'm wondering if you can kind of expand on this, is it's not just a great piece of music, it's also kind of a technological showcase because it was one of the first pieces written for the trumpet that actually had valves instead of just being a natural trumpet that gave the trumpet the ability to play the full range of notes instead of just sounding like a bugle.
That's right. So the work was composed in 1796. Premiered in 1800, so towards the end of Haydn's life, and it featured the key trumpet, so a revolutionary development in the history of that instrument. And so it really shows both the musicality and the athleticism of the instrument. And we couldn't have asked for a better soloist, Brianne Borden, who is an international star. I have the great pleasure of serving with her on the faculty at the University of Delaware, and I think she's just going to dazzle the audience with this performance.
Sodelo is a relatively new ensemble. It's got an interesting history. Tell me a little bit about the orchestra and what it's like to work with the musicians and the folks behind the scenes.
You know, we have an incredible story, and the story has many, many different aspects to it. And so Steve Greifer, who is our president of the board, is one of the co-founders of the orchestra. He moved, retired to the Southern Delaware area and put a note out on Facebook asking if there were like-minded musicians who would want to perhaps play some chamber music. And Eva DeGallo, who is also one of our co-founders, answered the ad, and together they said, listen, maybe not chamber music, how about an orchestra? And so a few weeks later, they contacted me at the university and asked if I knew anyone who might help them get off the ground. And I said, well, of course, I'd be glad to do it. And that was back in the spring of 2022. And at our first rehearsal, there was 35 musicians that came up, started as a string orchestra only. We performed our first concert that July to a sold out crowd, and it's just grown since then. Last year, we became a full orchestra. We're in our third season now. I'm overwhelmed and really humbled by all the support that we've received from the Southern Delaware community. They have come out in droves to our concerts. They've been supporters financially through donations. Our volunteers that make this organization run are the workhorse behind the group. And so we have a strong board and, of course, the musicians. I mean, it's what a pleasure to work with them every week. They're extraordinary volunteer musicians that come from all walks of life. We have doctors and lawyers and teachers and people who have been professional musicians, some who are just starting, some who are in their golden years, let's say. They're an extraordinary group of people who come because they want to share their passion of music.
I always like to ask conductors and music directors this question. It's a thing that's kind of endlessly fascinating to me. With all the repertoire out there, how do you put together a concert? How do you decide what music goes on the program?
It's a subjective process, right? But I think what we can agree on that is that there's certain criteria that we need to understand. And I think for a group like Sodelo, we really want to try and tie into the community. We want to, you know, there's a great love of nature in Southern Delaware. We're so close to the bay, to the ocean. And so coming up with a programmatic theme around water, I think was an easy one for this particular group. But putting together concerts, you know, I often think of it as a meal. Right. We want to have an appetizer. We need something that is going to be the bulk of the program and then something that sends somebody off, you know, that's sweet and sends them out into the world with some pleasure from the experience. But it's highly subjective.
So let's take that metaphor of the concert as a meal and kind of zoom out from just this concert and kind of talk for a second about programming in general. How do you, as a conductor, balance the audience favorites with the stuff that might be a little bit more of a challenging listen? How do you balance out the cake and the Brussels sprouts, as it were?
Absolutely. Well, I think that the different pieces shine a light on the other works on the program. And so you can reimagine a masterwork. This is a little off topic here, but everyone knows Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, right? It's an extraordinary work, one of the pivotal compositions of the repertoire. And to program that piece with something like something more challenging, like Martinu's Memorial to Lidice. This is a piece that was written during World War II. It was written in a span of a couple of days. I believe he was in New York City when he wrote that. And it was a commentary on a question of why. Where were the Allies when the Nazis came in and destroyed the city of Lidice? And in the piece, he quotes Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and he changes it a little bit. So it's sort of dun 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 bum, changes the pitch as a question, right? And so when you program that piece with the Beethoven Five, it opens up all this possible dialogue about extra musical ideas, right? And the reason that he quotes it, of course, is the Allies used that theme as Morse code. Short, 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 long was the Morse code for V or for victory. And so I think that those sort of things, always those thematic elements, are always an important part of my programming.
Thanks to the Southern Delaware Orchestra's co-founder and music director, James Allen Anderson, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we close out the green next with Enlighten Me and our conversation with Middletown-based author Mary Devine about her forthcoming memoir, Standing Up. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A forthcoming memoir traces one Delaware woman's difficult path through abusive relationships and ultimately a fruitful career in law enforcement. In Standing Up, Making the Best Out of Surviving the Worst, Middletown-based author Mary Devine offers a unique perspective that's part civilian, part law enforcement. She recounts her two early marriages and how those experiences shaped her career in law enforcement here in Delaware, where she spent years responding to the kinds of domestic violence calls she once lived through. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon talks with Devine about standing up, resilience, and finding agency beyond the things that happen to us.
Why did you decide to write this memoir? Was there a specific moment for you that stands out in that decision, or is this something that you had thought about doing for a while now?
Well, it didn't start out as an intention to write a memoir at all. It started out as a journal. And, I came upon it quite accidentally. My mom had a stroke at the same time that I was retiring from my police job. So I found myself with a lot of time and not a lot of things to do. So, and this is COVID reached out. And so everybody was looking for things to do at that time. And I just kept writing and writing. And then suddenly it started to turn into something. And, you know, people kept saying, you should write a book. You should write a book. And so I, little by little, I dabbled. And it soon grew into what I thought was going to be a book. And, you know, looking back at those things was really very healing. It took time, a lot of time. I'm embarrassed to admit that it took almost 8 years by the time I finished it. Yeah, I wrote and then I would put it on the shelf and write and put it on the shelf and summers put it on the shelf. But once I made that decision, I think things moved along quickly and I decided that I was going to be serious about this. And the main portion of the book that really got to me, the really reason that I put it out is that when I came full circle as a police officer, I had a case that my first case in detectives that mirrored my own experience, and following that young woman around and watching her, I saw myself. And my intent was to hopefully to somebody would get this book in their hands and they would relate to it. And of course, in the back of the book, I've offered some resource pages and some self-assessments that will allow people to look at it and see for themselves in the quiet times whether or not they might be experiencing this.
Yeah, I will say, well worth the wait as far as the timeline for this book goes. And I can certainly see, as someone who has read the book, speaking for myself, I can see why folks around you were saying, you know, you need to write a book. But I will say this is it's a deeply personal book, deeply personal memoir. And there's some real heavy stuff in it. Abuse, addiction, trauma. It's as gripping a read, and I told you this off air before we started, but it's as gripping a read as it is an emotional one. So how did you navigate the emotions that you just referred to in your answer there? How did you navigate those emotions that writing this brought up? How difficult or not was that for you?
You know, I thought I had worked through it already. And when I started having to identify particular things like dates and times. And then I started to realize that certain events or certain songs or like most of us have, it'll bring back a memory. But I remembered that those memories came back towardly. I mean, they just, you know, they were difficult to say the least, but some of them so memorable that I could remember how it felt, how it smelled, how, you know, all of my senses were just, you know, heightened. And it was really difficult. I took a lot of time. I mean, I sought counseling too. I talked to counselors about my feelings and what was happening there because they were so new to me. I thought I had put that on the shelf, but apparently it was time to take it back off the shelf and work through it, examine what my role was, why I did what I did, and why I didn't do some things I should have done, and found a way to let myself off the hook because I was young and I just was very naive. So a lot of it was I just wasn't ready yet.
This is something else you also touched on in terms of what the writing process, that entire process of putting the memoir together, how it impacted you. You know, obviously, you know, I can see how writing this, you know, like I said, putting it all together would have been therapeutic in many ways. And, you know, how was it therapeutic for you?
I think that it was, like I said, the examination of it, because I always looked at it as something horrible that happened to me. And that takes the responsibility out of it for me. And there is a responsibility in there. I knew at times that this was wrong and, you know, it shouldn't be this way. And I gave my partner excuses when he didn't deserve them, and without really identifying whether or not that was true or even talking to him about it. What it did was it changed my future behavior. So it helped me to look at what I saw then and say, well, that's where I didn't trust my gut. That's where I knew and I didn't move forward in the right direction. And now that knowing and that trusting myself has become really important to me.
Speaking broadly, one of the, you know, bigger, more defining themes I came away with, I think a lot of readers will come away with, is that we don't have to be defined by other people. We don't have to be defined by the bad things that happen to us or the negative experiences that we do endure. I know takeaways or themes can be subjective, but what are your thoughts on that and what you think defines standing up?
I absolutely agree. And I'm so glad you said that, because you always want to make sure that you've gotten through. And that tells me that that you got it. So, yeah, absolutely. What I know is that what happens to me is not who I am. You know, what I do with what happens to me is what makes me who I am. And so people say, oh, my God, you poor thing. I'm sorry you went through that. And I never look back that way. I don't regret it, because I wouldn't be where I am, and I wouldn't have done the things I've done. And I have had so far an amazing life. And you can have a good life. You can change your stars anytime. You know, it's a choice. It is a choice.
I read one review that called this raw, real, and relatable, and that the book is ideal for fans, an ideal read for fans of Tara Westover's Educated, which actually is sitting on this bookshelf behind me. The listeners can't see this, but on our Zoom call, but Tara Westover's Educated and Cheryl Strayed's Wild. So I feel like this book is for a lot of folks. It isn't for, you know, just a certain demographic or whatnot, you know, not just certain people. Am I in base in saying that?
Yes, because it isn't just domestic violence. It's any trauma. You know, there are so many things, so many evils in this world that trap people. Addiction is one. And I have an enlightened view of what addiction is like. Boy, I certainly got an eyeful. And it isn't anything like I thought it was. I didn't really have much experience with it, but any kind of trauma that someone goes through can put them at a stop, you know, can cause them to shut down, I guess, for a lack of a better way of putting it. It doesn't have to do that. And I think a lot of that comes down to blame and shame. And most of the time, trauma keeps us silent. You know, we keep it to ourselves because people don't want to hear our troubles. People don't want to hear our pain. Especially not over and over again. And trauma in itself can last a very long time, as most people know. You know, a death of a loved one, or you know, a suicide, or a loss of a career or a job that, you know, causes shame. So, yeah, I think that that this book speaks to anyone who's gone through something and can come out the other side, because I think you really just have to look for opportunities. And listen with your gut. Listen when people offer help, accept it. You know, we tend to, I myself, at least, I consider myself a type A personality, and, you know, I don't need any help. I'm good. I've got this. I'm okay. I got this. I have a strong faith. And I usually treat him the same way. Thanks God. I got this. You showed me the way. Now I'll take over. I'm good. And that's when things go south again. So, but we do need to reach out and communicate with our friends and our family members and let them know what we're going through and how it's affecting us, because it's hard to get your head straight when your heart's hurting.
Thanks to Middletown-based author Mary Devine and Arakon McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for a weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry, Martin Matheny, and Sarah Petrowich, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.